In this month's episode of the History Explorer podcast, we'll hear from the staff at the museum's Paper Conservation Lab as they discuss their work to analyze, document, repair, and preserve a personal Bible created by Thomas Jefferson. The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, or the Jefferson Bible as it's commonly known around here, is a volume created by Thomas Jefferson containing passages he chose from the four Gospels of the New Testament. Let's listen in as the staff explains how they repair and preserve books and paper objects here at the museum.
I'm Janice Dignito Ellis, and I'm the Senior Paper Conservator here at the National Museum of American History.
I'm Emily Rainwater. I'm a postgraduate fellow.
I'm Laura Bedford. I am the other postgraduate.
And I'm Sarah Emerson, and I am the intern here in the Paper Conservation Lab.
Generally, what a paper conservator will do is physically and chemically stabilize the artifacts that are paper-based, so that they can be both consulted by scholars and researchers and exhibited. So it could be nothing more than designing protective enclosures for long-term storage, or it could be a full conservation treatment sort of intervention if something is really, really has severe chemical or physical problems and it needs more active intervention. The Paper Conservation Lab deals with every document, pamphlet or trade catalog or art on paper.
Paper labels.
We have a lot of, you know, wooden or other types of three-dimensional artifacts that have paper labels on them. So we'll have to deal with the paper labels, anything from pharmaceuticals with paper labels to light bulbs with labels on them. You just never know.
Yeah. And today we're specifically going to speak about the Jefferson Bible.
The Jefferson Bible is, you can kind of think of it like Jefferson's personal scrapbook about the life and morals of Jesus Christ. He cut up passages from the four Gospels of the New Testament that he liked and thought represented Jesus's moral teachings, and he arranged them in a fairly chronological order and pasted them, actually glued them into blank pieces of paper, and created his own Bible, for lack of a better word.
So it's the Jefferson edition of
I guess
Holy
you
Bible.
Could say. Okay.
The curator who acquired the Jefferson Bible from Thomas Jefferson's great-granddaughter in 1895, put it on exhibit the year after at the Cotton Expo in Atlantic, Georgia, where it was like the culmination of this exhibit that the Smithsonian had put on there about the history of religion. It was labeled in that exhibit Jefferson's Bible, apostrophe S. The name has sort of been morphed and embraced as Jefferson Bible, even though technically it's not a Bible. This book was done when he was 77 years old, retired and living at Monticello. It was the culmination of a lifelong interest in moral teachings and Christianity. He actually did a previous version in 1804, which is called The Philosophy of Jesus. And we know about its existence because there are letters referring to it, but that book has since disappeared. I don't know if it disappeared because he was unhappy with it and it didn't fulfill his personal needs, or whether, who knows, maybe it's sitting in someone's hands right now. Mm-hmm. It is just not around. But the Jefferson Bible, or as he called it, the Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, was done by him in 1819 to 1820 while he was in retirement. It was actually a purchase. Smithsonian purchased it for $400. From his great-granddaughter. So this is something that remained in Jefferson's family. He thought religion was just between a person and their God. He said, "I am a sect unto myself." He really didn't discuss it with too many people. The Bible stayed with the family. He did not give it to the Library of Congress. It did not go to the University of Virginia. But this curator, when he was a young scholar, located the two English language source books, the New Testament books that Jefferson had cut up to make the Jefferson Bible. He found those maybe 20 years before he actually acquired the Jefferson Bible for the Smithsonian.
Now, was it well known that Jefferson had done this?
I think that they knew about it from letters, that he'd mentioned this pursuit in letters to Joseph Priestley and John Adams. and Benjamin Rorschach.
Now, this specific book, as it is right now, why does it need conservation?
The book was in too fragile of a condition to be exhibited for access to researchers. It simply couldn't be opened past about a 30-degree opening, so that's pretty slim. And it is one of the great treasures of this museum, and they wanted to be able to share that with the public, both in an exhibit and also in an online digital scan.
So why couldn't it be open past 30 degrees? What was physically wrong with the book at this point?
The leather cover it's very great leather, but it's still quite old, and it would flex and crack along the joint edges. And the pages themselves had become very brittle, especially because Jefferson had glued all of these clippings on, and the glue has interacted with the paper, and the paper itself is naturally aging, very brittle. The other problem was that the book was very tightly bound. There are a lot of linings on the spine, which is something that the bookbinder did on purpose for the style of binding, but it meant that the pages can't flex. They can't
bend over, you know, like as you turn a page.
Right.
Something has to bend.
Yeah.
And because of the way the binding was designed, very heavily lined on the spine, so the spine doesn't really move when you open the book. They did that on purpose because A, all the gold tooling would stay really nice, and B, it made the book close with a nice sharp snap, which is something that Jefferson actually wrote in a letter to his bookbinder that he liked. He didn't like American bindings because he said they were too spongy, and that's his word. He didn't want a spongy binding.
Okay.
He wanted something that was more like the bindings that were produced in London and Paris. And this bookbinder named Frederick Mayo, who was Jefferson's last bookbinder working in Richmond, Virginia, was trained in Europe. So he gave Jefferson a very French binding. So the spine is very lined, it's not flexible, and that's fine if you have paper that can flex. If the paper is supple and it has a nice drape to it, when you open those two like arcs that you see as the paper drapes, then you still have a functioning book. But ours, the paper front and back of every page is glued with animal glue and all these little clippings that Jefferson put on. So the paper really wasn't draping either. So now we have two inflexible elements, the binding and the paper, and which meant that when you opened it, you either damaged the book or you only opened it about as wide as the letter V.
It sounds like there's a lot of factors or specific little pieces of the type of binding, the type of paper, all these factors that go into how you're assessing what needs to be done.
And that's a good point, because you don't just look at it with a preconceived notion and say, yeah, we should do this.
Mm-hmm.
We really started with a full conservation assessment. So we wrote a glossary so that we were sure that all of us were using the same terminology. We designed a database so that when we looked at every feature on every page, we had a mechanism for documenting it. Our database is about 20,000 points of information, about 200 for, actually, well, more for each page. Before you can fix something, you have to figure out what's wrong, and that means both physically and chemically.
What happens next? What happens after that initial start to this project?
Chemical analysis. We can historically look at materials and think we know what they are, but it's really quite different to be able to verify what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, we would take microscopic samples and then send them.
First, I want to say, though, that those samples that we were taking are so tiny that you can't see it with your naked eye. Even after we had removed the sample and had it on a microscope slide, you could hardly see it. You had to look at it underneath the microscope.
And anything that Jefferson intentionally applied was not removed. So if his quill caught on a fragment or a piece of fiber on the paper and it made a little splash, it's those tiny little splashes that we were taking samples from.
The book, it's a three-dimensional object. I think of it as like a building. Like there's all these different parts that all have separate names and they all have to work together. And some of how a book is put together you can visually see from the outside. Other components of the binding structure you can only see after you've taken it apart. So part of what we did was a lot of looking, as Janice said, and a lot of photography, and different types of photography as well, because some things show up better under different wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking about describing the book, you start from the outside and sort of work your way in. And we literally called out every type, every component we saw in the binding. We talked about what it was, the name of the materials that were used to make it, how we thought it was made, and then you also talk about the condition. So, for example, if you're looking at the outside of a, like a paperback book, you're going to comment that the cover is a paperback cover. It's not a cover in leather. There's no gold tooling on it necessarily. It's been printed somehow, so you're going to assume that it's modern paper, modern materials, and maybe there's some sort of a covering.
Plus, there are certain features that you find. For example, this was done in a French way, and it just so happens that the binder was trained in Europe. So when you see features of an object that's in one part of the world that reflect another part of the world, then you start to make connections between maybe trade or literacy, or, you know, there's a much bigger picture issues that can be brought out by minutiae in an artifact. So we're looking at things that may be characteristic to this particular bookbinder, and we did discover some features that seem to be very characteristic of this person, which means that other bindings that may be out there and unattributed to this particular colonial bookbinder, which there are very few, because of the features that we've seen in ours, we may be able to determine that other bindings are also his. Now, we're fortunate because on the inside of this cover, Frederick Mayo put a binder's ticket, which is essentially a little advertisement. It's a sticker with his name on it saying, I made it in Richmond, Virginia. Other bookbindings by Mayo maybe don't have that, but maybe he used the same gold tooling on the outside. Maybe he has made the end bands the same way. End bands are those little silk braids that you see at the very top and the very bottom of the spine. We found that Frederick Mayo has a very distinct way of sewing them. I haven't seen other binders use that, so now that's probably another feature that is characteristic of Frederick Mayo. So again, it's kind of interesting to find these characteristics of colonial tradesmen, because then you can make larger pictures about, or more larger speculations about how the book trade was at that time, point in time. The book cover has been removed in one piece, and it's waiting to be put back on the pages. The pages have all been treated. They've all received their conservation treatment, all their mends. They have been separated out, so it's nice and easy for scholars to look at it now. It was very easy to do a beautiful digital facsimile of it, since they're flat pages. And we're finding that so many people are interested in seeing it that it's easier in the short run to leave it disbound in pages temporarily, so that people can see more things in one go.
Now, aside from the Jefferson Bible, what are some other maybe interesting or exciting objects that have come into this lab?
Every day it's a new adventure. You never know. I mean, sitting here right now, and this is just a random day, vellum, which is animal skin, passports from the late 1700s. So we're thinking about, well, let's look at the dirt on that passport and see where this document has been. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
We know it was on a ship, but we don't know where that ship went. Maybe we can find out. We have Matthew Brady amber type photos. Matthew Brady, of course, is the famous photographer who did all the Civil War battlefield photography. And, you know, one of those happened to come in this week, and we have a really magnificent slave ship manifest. Basically, it is a document that was in a ship's log that logs in human trafficking. So the ship's manifest has the names of the enslaved people and their ages and their children's ages and the physical characteristics of them, where they were, where they're going. I mean, that kind of stuff is very rare. Yeah, Charlie Brown. Yeah, we have Charlie Brown stuff. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's right. Also this week, some of Jim Henson's archives have come in. Some early scripts and some early drawings of Chicken Liver. Chicken Liver is one of his early puppets, right up there when the first Kermit was made. Chicken Liver was one of his best buddies.
Thanks to the Paper Conservation Lab for taking us behind the scenes. For the History Explorer podcast, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Join us again next month as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Podcast made possible by a grant from the Verizon Foundation.